One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the weekly exploration of the fascinating way music and songs become entwined with our lives and our life stories. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. Our guest this week is Walt Tversky. Walt was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and lived there for nearly 60 years before moving to Naples in 2005. He spent more than 50 consecutive years in commercial radio, starting in college at a local radio station as a gopher and working his way up to becoming a radio station group owner of 23 stations. Early in his career, Walt quickly rose from account executive to sales manager to vice president and general manager of the legendary WMMS 101.1 FM, The Buzzard in Cleveland. During that time, he partnered with concert promoters, co-sponsoring hundreds of clubs and major rock concerts, and got to meet, as his bio puts it, most of the major rock artists, and he's got the photos and memorabilia to easily back that up. Also during that time, The Buzzard was named Radio Station of the Year by Rolling Stone magazine for 5 consecutive years. Walt rounded out his half century plus in radio with Alpine Broadcasting Corporation's Wave 101.1 FM here in Southwest Florida, where he served as general manager and vice president of sales. Hey there, Walt. How are you?
Good morning.
Thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome.
Born in Cleveland?
That's correct.
If I do the math right, you lived there almost all or all of 57 years.
That's
is that
correct.
Right?
That's about right.
What makes Cleveland so great?
It's the home of rock and roll, rock and roll capital of the world. It was a great place to grow up. It was a great place to enter into the business world. And for me, a great opportunity to get into the radio business. It was family oriented. It had suffered through prosperity and then enjoyed prosperity and then suffered through a decline. And I remember at all the radio stations, we were always trying to be pro-Cleveland, prop up the town, take a positive spin, and give the people that are living there, including ourselves, something to look forward to with a more optimistic tone instead of the negative tone, because it was the butt of a lot of jokes, like the river that catches fire and so forth and so on. Probably the greatest thing that I feel I was able to contribute in that time with that positive, optimistic vein was we did an album that I was the executive producer on, and it was called Pride of Cleveland. And the album was locally distributed, of course, with some regional success, believe it or not, because we had some of the top bands that were Cleveland-based bands who volunteered to record and have their material on that album.
Cool.
And some of them went on to bigger things.
Well, we'll get to some of that stuff that you're teasing up. But when you were a kid, what was happening musically for you as a kid? Like, to paint the picture of the musical scene for you growing up.
Love that question. I think music was always in my veins. My father started by giving me accordion lessons, not being a cool instrument, but it was still a bass. I, of course, moved on to piano.
Did you know
organ.
It wasn't cool right
over
away?
Time, I knew pretty quick.
Probably was cool as a kid. You're like, this is cool. And then you realize.
Yeah, when you're 8, 9, 10 years old. Yeah. But my reckoning came at age 10, roughly at 10 years old, when I would listen to the new rock stations, the top 40 rock stations, on my treasured little Motorola transistor radio, the iPod of the day.
Did it have a little leather case?
It had a little leather case, so it wasn't really leather, but
leatherette.
leatherette. And it was a turquoise, a very mid-modern century.
What year would that have been?
1956, 1957.
Wow, so like the peak of the beginning of what we think of as rock and roll.
And radio took me in because that was the vehicle. That was the one and only place that you could source all this great new music. And of course, at that time, Top 40 was the big format, and that brought you a little bit more variety than the more linear formats that followed it as more stations came online. But the transistor radio for a 10-year-old was your link to excitement, to reality, to a world that you can only imagine.
Were your parents okay with rock and roll?
At first, they were not, and then they began to see that it's another form of music. So they were always very supportive of music and of all types of music.
What was the first band or musician that you identified with as a young person personally?
That would be Ricky Nelson, who I later met somewhere along the way before he left us. And also Buddy Holly and the Crickets, which made perhaps the strongest influence on me. The other was Everly Brothers, Dream, 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 and Wake Up Little Susie, all anthems. And I was blessed to meet the Everly Brothers some years later as well.
Did you have a record player in your house? And did you have a record player in your room?
I had a record player in the house, and it made its way to my room. And it came in a
little... So the answer to those questions was yes.
Yes. And it comes in a little box.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one was capable of playing 45 RPM records. And for those of you that don't know that, those are the little records with the big hole in the middle. And my parents had the mid-modern era... piece of furniture that was also the stereo and all built in. I was not allowed to touch. But it had the better speaker, so I would cheat and occasionally use that.
When they were looking too close.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you remember the first 45 that you owned as a young person that was yours?
The first one I purchased with my paper route money and was all of 59 cents, which was a lot of money back then, was Buddy Holly and the Crickets, That'll Be the Day.
Yeah. Why'd you buy it? Had you heard it on the radio and were hooked right away?
I heard it on the radio and I couldn't turn it off. It was captivating, you know, the instrumentation, the arrangement, the lyrics. It just grabbed me. And I found myself at a local early big box store that had a jukebox. And while my parents shopped, I found myself pumping either nickels or dimes into that machine incessantly from my paper route money. And I realized it would be a better deal just to buy the record. And that gives me more plays.
You were playing accordion and then you moved on to keyboard. Were you trying to play along to this new music you were falling in love with?
Yes. I had to learn some of the more standards and the classical, if you will, classic standards.
Like polkas and...
Yeah, exactly. Waltzes, you know, and, you know, almost a Lawrence Welk environment because that's what parents were listening to. But it didn't take long for me to realize, that's nice, and I appreciate it, but that's not my music.
Well, let's do your first song.
All right. As I mentioned...
It is the Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
That is correct. And That'll Be the Day by Buddy Holly and the Crickets, 1957. And as I said, I heard this song on a top 40 station in Cleveland on my tiny treasured aqua and cream-colored Motorola transistor radio, which was the iPod of the day. Played the song repeatedly on the jukebox and at a department store, and I was pumping dimes in there, and I realized I should just buy the record, which I did. I couldn't get enough of the song, intrigued by the beat, the basic three-chord blues-type arrangement, the vocals and instrumentation. I was 10 years old at the time, and the song hit me hard. And I knew right there and then that music was in my blood and rock and roll music was in my future.
Well, let's listen to it. This is Walt Burski's first song here on Three Song Stories. This is That'll Be the Day by Buddy Holly and the Crickets, recorded and released in 1957. And I looked this up with I'm Looking for Someone to Love on the B-side.
The flip side.
This is Three Song Stories. When was the last time you listened to that?
It's been a long time, but I remember all the lyrics. I love the instrumentation. Early introduction to that crisp Fender Stratocaster. Actually, it was a Telecaster guitar. And, you know, the clear recording value of it with the crisp drums. You know, just the simplicity was the beauty and also the power behind that.
If that was the first band that you really liked, identified with, and that was the first 45 you owned, do you remember learning the news of his death?
Yes, it was sad. It was tragic. It just hit me because I was familiar with not only his music and his group's music, but also the Big Bopper, you know, Chantilly Lace, Pretty Face, and many of the other artists that perished in that tragic plane crash.
Hmm. In high school, where'd you fit into the equation?
Well, at that time, there were the greasers, mm-hmm. if you will, and then there was the collegiates. That's sort of the two groups. I was somewhere in the middle. I had friends on both sides of the aisle, if you will, and I was just trying to be myself. And music was really and radio was the focus that I kept. And musically, people were always together. That brought those groups together, if you will.
Did you play any bands during your high school years?
I didn't really play in a group until around 10th grade. And then 10th grade, 11th grade, and 12th grade, I had a group. And it was kind of a interesting group because we would play anywhere from a 3 to a 6-man band. We would play for bars illegally because we were underage. We would play occasionally for weddings. We would play, you know, bat mitzvahs.
But you were playing gigs then, though.
Oh,
you
I was
were
playing
just
gigs.
A garage band. You were
no,
playing
no, we,
gigs.
No, we actually played gigs. And it was a tremendous exposure, and the band could be expanded or
did it have a name?
It was called Walt and the Marquise.
Oh, so you got lead billing.
Yeah, of course. No, I'd say.
What kind of music were you playing?
We would play a lot of the popular top 40 songs of the time. We started with "That'll Be the Day," but that already was getting dated, and we had many newer genres of music coming on. And we tried to learn. It was much more simple at the time. Most of them were 3-chord progressions, blues riffs, what have you. We had a bass guitar played by Dick Jacklich, who lives in Bonita
Electric
Springs.
Electric bass,
yes, and. Dick was one of my best friends. And
he lives here in town?
He lives in Bonita Springs. And he has that beautiful 1963 candy apple red Fender jazz bass, which he bought for $242. And it is worth $13,000 now.
Wow.
Sorry. But we had good equipment. We had Stratocasters. We had Fender amps. I had a Farfisa organ. Which was, if you remember Dave Clark 5, that's where I saw that first. So it was a great way to actually be on the front lines and learn to play and learn the creation of music. And it was a lot of fun. And we always had a few bucks in our pockets because we were playing gigs Friday nights and Saturday nights.
Do you remember going to your first concert?
Yes.
Would it have been in your high school years?
Yes. It was 1964 and it was the Beatles.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And that first one was at the Cleveland Stadium, and it was absolutely mind-blowing, you know. And it was a real lesson. The Association was the opening group.
Were you a big Beatles fan?
Yes. The music, obviously, we first heard on the Ed Sullivan Show when I dropped what I was doing to scurry home like the rest of America and tune the TV on and see that black and white image of Ed Sullivan introducing the Beatles, and that was it. But at the same time, we all sat and recognized, oh my goodness, music has made a profound change, and we better get back in the basement and start learning some of this music. What we ran into is we were rather simple musicians.
Beatles are not simple musicians.
And the
learning, you were like, what chord is that?
Yes, and learning the Beatles songs, which we did not learn too many of them, or at least well, was a challenge beyond belief. It was, and in some cases, we just gave up. And then we also opted for some Stone songs to fill that in because they were coming on strong. And once again, some of the music was tough to play, or we didn't have the equipment. We didn't know about fuzz tones, and we didn't know about the wah-wah pedals and all the technology that was starting to happen back then.
Was the Ed Sullivan moment one for your whole family? Were your folks into it enough, too?
Yes. It was mostly my sister and I that were
They were watching you watch the Beatles, your parents?
I think that was more – and dad sort of scratched his head and said, we'll see. They'll be gone in no time.
And, meaning never.
And my mom, you know, she thought, oh, that's nice.
Stones, Beatles. Some people say that you had to love one or the other. Was there one that was more loved by you?
No, loved them all.
Yeah.
Depend on the song. It always depend on the individual tune.
You said you grew up loving radio. When did the idea of working in radio enter your brain?
The day I built my first Crystal set when I was maybe 10, 11, 12.
Huh.
And I was intrigued with the concept of radio.
Was FM around yet?
No.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out, make sure we...
It was, but it really wasn't.
Yeah.
It was out there. FM, there was a couple terms that... What does FM stand for?
The technology existed, but it was not how people listen to radio.
Yeah, and FM stood for free music for the commercial broadcasters. And so I was intrigued with getting signals, being able to bring in AM stations, WCFL in Chicago, the Big 8 in Detroit.
And some of those AM stations could go for like halfway around the world practically.
That's where you had the 50,000 watt clear channel stations that were just boomers. They were flamethrowers. But that was the source, again, of more music, more input, more ideas. That quickly progressed into local stations in Cleveland, WHK, KYC, which was KYW originally, and then an upstart called Wixie 1260, which had the lowest power, but it was the best music format. So those all influenced me, and those opened doors for me where at 18, right out of school, I was able then to get a job as a gopher. Part-time, $1.25 an hour, and all the records you could take. That was the deal. And that allowed me to learn from the ground up how that business works, how a radio interfaces with the music, and of course, the artist and the input the artist makes to all of that.
What were the kinds of things they made you do right away, like at the beginning of being a gopher?
Oh, I loved it.
I can tell. You look like a 12-year-old when you said that.
I had to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning.
But you were walking into a radio station.
But I was there and my friends weren't. And so I remember the first time I got there, I was there at 4:30 instead of 5 o'clock a.m., by the way. I had to make sure that the DJ who was on all night – who was a wonderful guy named Jim LaBarbera, who is still on a station in Cincinnati, WLW. I had to make sure he had everything he needed to close his show. But more importantly, I had to get ready for the morning guy, who was supposed to start at 5:30, but usually he had a hangover, so he'd come in at 6, 6:30. but I had to pull his 45s. The music director left me a stack of records. Because all the playlist was controlled.
So this was still purely off of records. We hadn't moved on to carts and stuff like that yet.
And the only thing on the carts
were the
ads. So what I would do is I would take the log and the log, of course, telling you what to do and what time and what records to play. I would stack the records in the order that they're being played. Secondly, I would get the commercials and put those in at the order they're being played, so that they could proceed. And in between there, he did talk segments and news, weather, sports. Then I had to run into the newsroom. This is all before 6 a.m. and pull off the UPI wire or the AP wire. Any breaking news?
Yeah, anything blew up basically that you had to make sure you got on the air.
Exactly. And then I would do the rip and read. I'd do the rip part, and I'd have that ready for the newsman, who walked in at 6 or 6:30.
So you were doing important stuff. You weren't just like emptying the trash. I thought maybe gopher meant they were like, go get something.
Well, I did that too. I did that too. But it was such a great foundation. And the more you showed some proficiency and interest in, the more they let you do.
Yeah.
And it really flowed nicely. I got to a point then I was editing the tapes with the splicing. People won't even know what I'm talking about because you have Pro Tools now. But I used to have to take physical tape and actually splice and make sure you couldn't really hear the splice and put it on the old Ampex monster machine. They actually had a cutting block, a splicing block on it. And the better you got, the better production values you would get, the better it sounded for the station. Now you'd have to transfer that to the cart.
Yeah.
Which
kind of looked like a little 8-track.
It looked like exactly. It looked like the old 8-tracks. So that was really critical information. We got through that. There was a humorous moment. The morning show guy, who we'll go unnamed, he, like a lot of the DJs in the Top 40 era, he liked to go out and party the night before and most every night. And he was known to have a few too many. And we had a deal that if he didn't show up on time, that I would just make sure to start on time. I would make sure to do the legal ID. And I would just basically, without speaking other than the legal ID, I would basically run and get his show going so he could stroll in hungover at 6:30, whatever, 6:20.
The better you were at that, the later he kept coming in,
and
probably.
That's what happened. Well, one day he didn't show up. And I started to really become concerned. And I didn't know where he was. So I thought, I have to keep this show going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did all of the things that I was supposed to do. But there were times when you had to open the mic and give the legal ID, or you had to give the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the hotline rang. And there was a light in the studio that would flash like a strobe.
Uh-huh.
And that was the hotline. That meant somebody important was calling. So
the public didn't know that number.
Of course. And I picked up the hotline, and the owner of the station, Norman Wayne was his name, wonderful man. He said, "Who's this?" And I said, "This is Walt Tversky." "Well, who are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm the assistant producer, Gopher." And he said, "Well, where's Finan?" I just said the jock's name. He's dead now. I said, "Well, sir, I got a call from the Parma police. He's in jail. He was picked up last night, and he's not going to be here this morning." And he said, "Geez," he said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "just keep doing what you're doing, and whatever you do, don't miss any commercials." And that was my first introduction to being on the air on a top-rated radio station.
Wow.
In Cleveland, Ohio.
How long were you at that station before you moved on to something else?
I was still in college, so I resumed my studies.
What were you studying?
I started out in journalism at Kent State University, and then that opened up into telecommunications, and so it was radio and TV, of course.
What was your first job out of college?
I stayed with WKSI right out of college, and then I did my internship there formally. And at that time, I got 14 hours of A from that, and that helped my cum. And so I stayed on with them, but there were no full-time openings. So then I moved on to go into sales. At a station that was called WMMS, but at the time it wasn't – the call letters became legendary, but not at that time.
Well, we'll get to WMMS, but I want to back up because we glazed past Kent State. You were telling me before we started talking that you were there when the incident known by people as the Kent State Massacre happened, right?
That is correct. And sadly, that's at the same time I was doing the internship at WKSI 1260 and in Cleveland. I would get up early and drive, you know, rain, snow, and sleet up to the job. And we were walking to get our cars. My friend and I were walking to get our car to go to our respective jobs. And because we already were working, we basically had graduated and we're just filling the time at our apartment. And suddenly, you know, we were aware of this terrible incident. And sort of instinctively, I went to a payphone in a dormitory nearby, and something clicked in, and I called the newsroom, and I said, I introduced who I was, and I told them what was happening. And I just remember, I said, "You aren't going to believe this, but they're shooting students here. They've just shot a number of students." And that became a that became an entire episode for me, and I tried to be the reporter on the scene because I was in literally the first person. But then when I tried to make subsequent calls, all the phones were down. Mm. Everything was either blacked out or cut off. So all I could do was frantically drive to the station and tell them what I had witnessed and seen. Interestingly, sometime later, I received a call. They fed this up to ABC Network. And so I was on ABC Network with
this. So they had you on tape when you called in?
When I called in the first time.
Gotcha.
And then they fed that. So then I got subsequent calls from everybody from the FBI to what did you see? Can you give us a report? To James Michener, the author, who asked many years later about what I saw so he could write a book.
Wow.
About it. It was a defining moment in my life.
Let's do your second song, and then we'll get into WMMS, The Buzzard, afterwards. Second song, Beach Boys.
That's right. The year is 1964. The song is Don't Worry, Baby. And I heard the song on WHK AM at my home in my old beater car. I was late for a date because I was sitting in my car listening to the radio station exclusively debut the song by playing it over 15 minutes straight. The lyrics spoke to me as an older teen. I actually drove an old rusty 1953 Plymouth. The Beach Boys song lyrics capture that male fantasy that evoked drag racing, hot rods, hot chicks, as well as the wider appeal of surfing off the beach Eden of Southern California. Later that same year, I would meet and interview the Beach Boys for my high school newspaper after being selected in a journalism contest by a local DJ from the Top 40 station. This interview also began a lifelong business and personal friendship with Mike Love and the other Beach Boys that I still enjoy to this day.
Hmm. Did you say they played it like 10 times in a row or something?
Yeah, the radio station got the exclusive. That was a big thing.
And so they would literally just start it over, drop the needle again.
And the Beach Boys were and are so hot that scoring that exclusive was a big deal, and the other stations didn't have it, so you shoved it on. We have it, you don't. And they would say, exclusive, exclusive.
What color was your car?
My car?
Yeah.
It was a rusty blue.
Was it moving when you were doing this, or was it sitting still?
Bald tires, cracked window. But in my mind, I was driving a vet.
Well, let's listen to it, imagining you sitting in that car. This is Don't Worry, Baby by the Beach Boys from their album Shut Down Volume 2, released in 1964. This is Walt Tobersky's second song on Three Song Stories. This is Biography Through Music. If you had known while you were listening to that you were going to get to interview them, would that have blown your mind? Or did you feel like maybe you were around that enough at that point that it was plausible?
I thought it was plausible. I didn't even think of it at the time.
Yeah.
But I was comfortable with it when there was a selection made by the local DJ to people who are editors of their high school newspapers, and I was one.
Yeah.
And we had a lunch, and his name was Ron Britton. And he was the DJ on WHK, and he selected another high school reporter and myself, representing my school, to come to a concert that he was putting on through the radio station. Again, his name was Ron Britton. That's a time when the British groups are really coming on strong. He decided to do an American band theme concert. So it was called the Britton American Show. And it was Ivan and the Sabres, a local band called the Grasshoppers, which, by the way, lead guitarist was Benny Orr of the Cars.
Huh. Wow.
Later on. And then the Shangri-Las, which that's the first time I ever saw like tough Jersey girls. And then, of course, the headliner was the Beach Boys. No, excuse me, Jay and the Americans. Then the Beach Boys. And part of that was we got to sit down with them and talk to them, and we had some quality time. And then I subsequently wrote a story in the high school newspaper about them. But then I was also writing as a teen reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which was a large newspaper, and they had a teen section on Fridays. And a really wonderful woman named Jane Scott was the editor of that page, and so she liked the fact that I got to meet them and talk to them. She liked what I wrote, so I ended up having an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Teen Time, and it was all about – there was a music section.
Hmm.
So I maintained the relationship by sending them, the Beach Boys manager, a copy of the newspaper articles. And the reciprocal was a thank you and an invitation to come to the next concert, which was about a year later. And I went, and everything was as planned. And then one thing led to another, and Mike, who's a very good conversationalist, he and I struck up a good conversation. And we just stayed in touch after that. And he being the person producing the music, me being the being in radio to help them get it played.
Huh.
And so one thing led to another, and that was basically a relationship I enjoy to this day. And it's very deep and with many, many wonderful stories. That relationship will continue next Friday at the Barber B. Mann when they play there.
Cool. Let's talk about WMMS. You started working there before it became the station that it's most well known for. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it was the only job open in town. It was a station that had less than a one share. It was an FM station.
A one share, does that mean 1% of people listening to the radio?
Roughly, yes.
Roughly?
Okay. Roughly, yeah. So it was a low-end station, and they were playing a format called Hit Parade 70. Drake Chenault was the
– What year would this be?
It was a canned format, 1970.
Okay.
And it was a brief stint, just about a year, but it was a good foundation in radio sales. And but it was owned by Metro Media, who then subsequently sold it to a wonderful man named Milt Maltz.
I like that name, Milt Maltz. Rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, and so at the end of the day, I reapplied at because I went to another station called WNCR for a couple of years ago. It was kind of a underground station, same thing, not a highly rated station, but almost a testing ground for the new and emerging format of progressive rock or acid rock or underground rock, as it was called at the time. And that gave me a good foundation of almost 2 years. So when I rejoined the station when Milt bought WMMS, we were able to start from the ground up. At that point, it had a 1.2 share.
And this is 1973.
And yes. And so by the time we were done with it, we had a 21.7 share of the market. We had a massive audience. We did all the major concerts. We were Rolling Stone magazine station of the year 5 years in a row.
You were legendary.
No, legend in my own mind.
I mentioned it to Mike Braun and he goes, "Oh my God."
No. Well, honestly, we were younger people following our instincts and our passions, and we were blessed enough to have a place that allowed us to do that, because Milt was more interested in the AM at first, and it was a news talk station, and I remember him saying, "Well, play whatever you want, just don't lose the license," and so he gave us the latitude and the laboratory to experiment, to try new music. And there was a wealth of music. We were bombarded with albums. That's when it was no longer singles. It was albums coming up. And that was a very important incubation period for a format. Mind you, this was going on around the country. And a lot of the Metro Media stations, MMR and WBCN in Boston, KLOS in Los Angeles, KMET in Los Angeles, New York. This was happening simultaneously. We just happened to be in the Cleveland part of that. And album radio then really got its footing. And so we took off from there. And we expanded into becoming partners with the Belkin Productions. So we would actually work with the record companies directly, with the artists directly. We would work with the promoter, and we actually became a partner with the promoter. And our concerts developed a system where we would break a record, then have the artist in a club or a small hall, and then move them to a medium-sized hall. And that would culminate in a stadium show with as many as 80,000 people in the Cleveland Stadium for a multi-artist show.
You were doing sales.
Yes.
Probably a lot easier to do sales in a 21.7 share than a 0.5 share, right?
That was right. But I was on both sides of the equation, and I liked the other side better. It was not easy because we were up against some formidable competition in the beginning, but we developed a very strong sales staff, and we had a massive, amazing, talented programming staff who really made the product. I had greatest respect for John Gorman, who was the music director and program director, and he put that great staff together. He gave us this great product to work with, and then our job was to take it and monetize it, and after that also to continue cross-promotion and enhance and expand it.
I found on YouTube a air check from 1976. We're going to play it for you. This is This Is Your Life, Walt Tversky.
A buzzard in quad. WMNS, Cleveland.
Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes there from the album I Don't Want to Go Home, and a tune called Fannie Mae. Some real fine music on that record, you know. And we had Al Green before that with Take Me to the River. Andy Fairweather Lowe gave us Watch Out for La Booga Rooga. And it's 6:56. This is Charlie Kendall. Good morning. Charlie, yeah. It's Wednesday. It is hump day in Cleveland, and it's 65 degrees. Kind of cloudy out this morning. Should be partly cloudy. Chance of some showers, and it's going to be hot flash.
A hot flash?
A high somewhere up near 80 before the day is over. It's 65 right now, and let's check the listener line and see who's awake.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Charlie.
How are you?
Hey, great. I just called you up and wish you a happy hump day.
Which one are you then?
Could you play Already Gone by the Eagles?
Gotcha.
Would you do that for me?
Of course.
Oh, wow, that's really nice.
What are disc jockeys for?
Well, I don't know. Play records, I guess.
That trip down memory lane?
Oh, my God. Charlie Kendall. He was legendary. We got lucky enough to get him from Philly, from Boston. And he was one of the original jocks and just a great, great guy, great broadcaster.
Did you watch WKRP in Cincinnati?
Yeah, we did.
There had to be some resonance anyway.
Yeah, there were some similarities.
Started with a small share, tried something new. I mean, I recently rewatched it, so it's kind of fresh in my brain.
It was pretty much an accurate reflection of the interplay between the air staff, the management and ownership. The irony is when I bought my first radio station, WQAL in Cleveland, when I purchased the station, I walked into the then general manager's office and I was astonished because there on the wall, big as life, was a large fish. and it was a big swordfish, just like on WKRP.
Like Arthur Carlson's office?
Yeah, exactly. I stood there in shock. And the first thing I said, get that damn thing out of here.
Your bio that you sent me said that you've met and worked with most of the major rock artists. So as you were showing me the picture album from before and some of the pictures, do you have any fun stories of any of the artists that you got to interact with that you could share with us that wouldn't like give away any secrets that wouldn't be posted on social media if it existed at the time?
Okay.
Or are there so many that it's just like it's one big blur of a tapestry?
There is kind of a blur, but it followed a certain pattern. And usually it was an after show late, and you know, you'd want to meet with them, talk to them, and most importantly, develop that relationship so that when they came back again or when they came out with a new record, they say, yeah, we like those guys at MMS. Let's make sure they get the record first. We worked very hard at that. But most of the activity was after show. Honestly, some of it was just in passing. Not quite as cold as today's meet and greets are. In many cases, we developed a one-on-one, very deep and strong relationship, not only with the record company and the promoter, but also with the artists themselves. Because we worked hard to maintain the identity of WMMS with the artist, and they knew we were an artist-friendly station. We knew we'd give we would play their record. We would give it a shot. We would back them as much as we could, and we did it without any other encouragement or any other
incentive.
Incentive. It was strictly because we liked the music, and we were very careful with that, and that paid off because that came back time and time again when an artist would see that you back them up. And so if they had maybe a soft record, I mean, you still tried.
Mm-hmm.
But then when they came out with a strong record, or let's say when they came to town, you could do that. We did a lot of behind-the-scenes things. I like to pull promotions. When we were really underway, The Who were really very big, of course, as they grew and got bigger and bigger. So we made an arrangement to bring The Who into Cleveland, and we wanted us to be the exclusive. Well, what happened, other radio stations would – once you made the exclusive announcement, the other radio stations would simply come on 5 minutes later and say they had the exclusive. So I said, there's got to be a way to make this very unique. And what we did was we did a deal where in order to get the tickets, you had to make your check or money order payable to WMMS. The other stations then, who had been teasing that they're going to have the information, they were then obligated to hold their nose and say our call letters on their station, which was death for them.
I see. You planted a little poison pill.
Yeah. And that's the kind of clever promotions that we would do. Lots of fun things. One night with after the Who show, there's another Who show, Keith Moon being the clown that he was, he walked up to one of our DJs. And at a cocktail party afterwards, and it was a little wild, you know. He had a Cook County sheriff's costume on because he liked to dress up, and he starts.
Keith Moon did.
Yeah, and so, and he's three sheets to the wind at this point, and our one of our announcers came over to talk to him, and he took the handcuffs out and he handcuffed our announcer Kid Leo. To some girl that he just met. And, I mean, he would do silly things like that. I mean, there's so many stories. It's, you know, I do remember a couple fights and arguments, which I won't get into, but it was pretty sad.
Can you remember, you know, a band that was coming to town that you guys at the station had never interacted with before that you guys were all particularly excited for? You know, was there like, oh, they're coming?
David Bowie. Yeah.
Huh.
We thought he was a unique and special talent, which he is
yeah,
and was.
Yeah, clearly is and was, yeah.
And he was not real approachable at first, but that was in the Ziggy Stardust days, and we took a chance and backed what was a very bizarre show. And we put 11,000 people in Public Hall in Cleveland, and from then on we had a friend. And as his shows got bigger and more complex and he became more popular, he always remembered us. He was always good to us.
Wow. So you left WMMS. When did you wind up owning or operating your first radio station?
WMMS gave me a tremendous platform and awareness in the financial community. And that's a time when radio was then – there was no internet, and that was the darling business. Some of the more progressive bankers, and there weren't many at the time – began to see the value in broadcast media. And so with the help of some young, hip bankers and a couple good friends and partners, I was able to put together, riding off the high of the heels of my WMMS notoriety, if you will, for success. And what they were looking at was not so much the radio and records part of it, they were looking at the fact that I was converting almost 58 cents of every dollar to profit.
Hmm.
And they said, that's pretty good. So that gave me a nice loan facility where I took everything I had worked for, owned, every penny I had, money I don't, and I pledged my firstborn and was able, signed personally, and able to get my first radio station at the time I was 38 years old.
Which station?
It was called WQAL. No. The irony is, it was an easy listening station. And so I go from rock and roll.
This could be a spinoff of WKRP.
to easy listening. And they thought, oh, my God, this is insane. But it was the only safe opportunity because MMS was Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
And I just left Godzilla.
So this was in the same market.
Same market. And I knew better than to go up against not only that Godzilla of a radio station, but I also didn't want to go against the hand that fed me, which was Milt Maltz, who was a wonderful man. So when I told him of my plans to leave, and I said, Milt, this is a unique opportunity for me to do what you did and to get into business for myself. And he said, you're not going to come up against us, are you? I said, no, I know better. And I respect you. And I'm going to pursue this other format. I'll apply some of the marketing principles, but it's a different format and it's a different world. He said, well, that's good. And he has this powerful voice. He said, because if you do, I'll help you. But if you come up against me, I'll crush you.
I will break you.
and then he had this wonderful, ha, 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 like, and so he is still, and to this day, a friend and a wonderful mentor, and really the person that gave me the entree, if the entry into owning my own radio station. We built that up rather quickly, and we took it from being, I think, 12th in the market to number two behind MMS.
Hmm.
We actually tied almost at that time. MMS had about an 18 share. I had a 17 share.
With the easy listening.
Yeah, totally different. Different time, different format. And I remember the big moment came on when I began to break the rigid format that the format gurus had put in place on a national basis. And it was called Bonneville. And I broke the format and I started adding vocals. That was heinous, but it worked. Why play an instrumental Neil Diamond when you can play Neil Diamond?
Huh.
Why play an instrumental Barbra Streisand when you can play Barbra Streisand? It worked, and we were serving that market well. We also, taking some of my MMS concert days, I started producing at a local dinner theater concerts because there were a host of these acts that were Vegas-type acts that were coming through this dinner theater. So we took the same principles of promotion and just transposed it to, if you will, the 50-plus audience.
Hmm. How many radio stations did you end up owning over the years before you came down here?
Well, after we did that, give or take, because sometimes you would buy and sell and buy, and some we never even really got to know.
It was
anybody.
Like Monopoly with radio stations.
Yeah. And we ended up, I think it was 23 stations at one point.
Wow.
And we had expanded from the one station in Cleveland to markets like Indianapolis, Tulsa, Jacksonville, Florida, Anaheim, California, Norwalk, Connecticut, Virginia Beach, Virginia, San Juan, Puerto Rico, which was a tremendous profitable station. Everything then was going quite well. And at that point, I was approached by a broker. And the broker said, we have a buyer interested in your radio group. They want to buy a medium market radio group. We were a medium market, not a big market. We were a medium market station group. And at that time, I'm not for sale. We were doing fine. He said, well, at least talk to this guy. So we go in a dark room at one of the NAB conventions, and we meet a fellow named Marty Pompadour. And he was pretty well known in the business as a TV guy, real strong operator and owner. But he wanted us to meet his partner. And his partner was right out of Central Casting, handsome, tan, smooth, and it was none other than Elton H. Rule. Elton being the co-founder with Samuel Goldenson of ABC Television.
Wow.
Elton Rule, who was Aaron Spelling's best friend, who went on to have Love Boat and all those hits in the glory days of TV.
Did he make you an offer you couldn't refuse?
And so after some negotiation with all the pencil pushers and this and that, we had a fabulous offer for cash. No stock, no games, no performance. It was a buyout, and it was a tremendous multiples, and I realized I could hold the stations for 3, 4, 5 more years, and I wouldn't do as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agreed to sell. And at that time, then when the deal closed, my financial partner was a man named Tony Osepic, wonderful man. We then were asked to stay on, and they say we have another $100 million to spend in our second fund. The first fund that bought us was called ML Media, or Merrill Lynch Media, and the second was ML Media Opportunity. And they said, go out and buy more radio stations. We have to spend the money because we don't want to give it back.
So you got to spend their money.
And so we spent it as if it were ours. We weren't making acquisitions fast enough for them, and we were being – our due diligence was so exhaustive that they said, you can relax the due diligence a little bit.
Hmm.
Your standards are way too strict.
More like Monopoly, Walt.
Yeah. Well, and I was very uncomfortable with that. But nonetheless, that allowed us to expand. So we did that for 2 years. And then after that, that was the end of that arrangement, and it was a wonderful time. It was a great period to grow and really meet some wonderful people at a level I never deemed remotely possible.
Huh. Let's do your third song, Mr. Bob Dylan.
Okay, now it's going to get complicated. Performed at the Bob Dylan 30th Anniversary Celebration at Madison Square Garden on October 16th, 1992, affectionately referred to as Bob Fest. Starring in this historic version of My Back Pages was none other than Roger McGuinn, Tom Petty, Neil Young, Eric Clapton, George Harrison, Chrissie Hynde, the band, and in the end, Bob Dylan, backed by Jimmy Keltner on drums and G.E. Smith on guitar, capped it off chiming in on the last part of the song in his inimitable style to wrap up this finale. The key phrase, in my opinion, was, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Hmm.
So there's the cryptic and complex part of music that is a long way from my first choice of That'll Be the Day by Buddy Holly, which is your basic lyrics, three-song progression, or the beautiful love song, Don't Worry, Baby. Dylan, in my opinion, and in this very performance, with the surrounded by the musicians, the power of these musicians that were surrounding him, showed how complex the music is, how deep it can be.
Were you at that performance, or did you see that performance?
I was not at that performance. I was invited to go, and I was unable to go, and I regret it to this day.
Wow.
But it's still, in my opinion, the single best live performance ever done, period. That's my opinion.
Well, let's listen to it. This is our guest today, Walt Taberski's third and final song on Three Song Stories. This is My Back Pages by Bob Dylan, the live version from his 1964 album, originally Another Side of Bob Dylan. Did you ever see Bob Dylan?
I saw Bob Dylan years and years ago at the University of Michigan at a concert with probably 22,000 other people, and I enjoyed every minute of it. That was the one and only time.
Huh. Have you seen a lot of concerts that you went to on your own, not through work over the years, or have all your concerts been because of work one way or another?
99% of my concerts were work-related, and therefore I never felt the impact of ticket prices.
Does it feel weird to sit in the audience?
I rarely sit.
You know what I mean? Like, well, I've been to a lot of – I'm usually creeping around the edges of productions, so sitting there like a civilian is sometimes kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm a bad civilian. The only time I'm a good civilian was when I saw the Cleveland Orchestra at Artist Naples.
Hmm.
Then I'm a good civilian. We had some friends in the orchestra, and so that's a happy time because I can get into the music, and I'm really a civilian. But no, concerts for me were basically, as I told people, my work was your entertainment. So I had to keep my head on my shoulders, particularly if we were doing head counts and we were doing other things. So I would float, and I'd like to watch people. So I would float out in the audience. I was usually backstage.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the artists that I would see in performance, I saw basically their backs or their sides, because that's my vantage point, which is one of the stage sides. And then I would float in and out, just seeing how people are reacting to the music, just float around the concert, be it a big stadium show with 80,000 or being a small club. That was all very interesting. And it was sort of like passive research. I could learn, listen, and then take it back.
You showed me that this book you have with this the Who drum cover on it. In that picture, you're doing exactly that. You're sitting mm-hmm. stage side. Tell the short version of the book that I'm holding next to me with the drum cover on it.
Yeah, the Who. They've always were in my life, and you're probably wondering, why didn't I pick a Who song? Well, that's when I do the 300 song story. The Who I first met, as we talked about, and it was in 1967. I was still doing the part-time job at the radio station, and we attended the concert. I happened to be lucky enough to be there backstage and watch them. The Who were then the opening act for Herman's Hermits.
Strange aside, my first concert I ever went to was we drove up to the Charlotte County Fair in 1986 because that was when the Monkees were having their revival on MTV.
Yes.
And it was the Monkees and Herman's Hermits.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
My first concert. Yeah.
Well, poor Herman. And I can't repeat verbatim on the radio what Herman and Peter Noon said. When the Who started smashing their guitars and throwing their drums.
Different energy levels.
Yeah. And he just said, well, I think we are. And they went on as troopers and played their gig, and half the people left. But that's the first time I really ever got to meet the Who. And they were again, the opening act. They were big in Britain, but they were just starting to get traction here. And, you know, that's the music and the power was so great, and the antics of the octopus hand of Keith Moon. He was so fast. The massive power of their playing was just staggering.
And for kids who don't understand what you kind of just mentioned, they kind of destroyed things at the end of their set.
And yeah, there's many, many stories, but in this particular iteration, Keith kicked over one of the songs, I think it was Substitute. He kicked over the drum set, and then it wasn't good enough. He threw it out in the audience, and there's a photo that was captured
of it in the air on the way to the audience.
The bass drum, virtually the entire kit was on its way out into the audience, and there was of course a band pit, but it crashed into part of the band pit and went over, and so we were out picking up the pieces, and. Their manager said, help me, we got to get the equipment back in. And I helped, and later the next day when I met them to say goodbye and thank them for playing, my reward was to get one of the drum heads, some sticks, some broken guitar bits, and what have you. I put all those in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for many, many years, and some I just recently auctioned a couple years ago at the Bonhams Auction in London. So I felt like it was time for that drum head to go home.
And you're a non-performer inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, right?
That's correct.
So you get to, like, get in free when you go there and say, I'm on the list.
Yeah, I'm on the backstage list. I don't know how to behave going in the front door. Right? I'm a backdoor man, you know?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
So, that was another Pride of Cleveland thing where, you know, it was the first time, you know, where radio, we were there already, and we had a wonderful state senator and then who became governor and mayor of Cleveland first, George Voinovich. And it was a time where we all got together and we said, we need to unite all the factions, not just people in radio and entertainment. We're there already. We need to get the legal community. We need the business community, the banking community, the civic community. We need to unite and show them that we can do this. And so a massive, massive campaign was put together with the best and most influential and the hardest working people I've ever had the pleasure of working with. And we did the early USA Today push to get to be the city.
Mm-hmm.
We had formidable competition, no less than New York City, where the New York board wanted it there. But we tough Clevelanders wanted it in Cleveland, and we got it. And then when we got it, we said, oh, my God, what do we do with it? Well, you build it. And the shovel, the first time they turned over the shovel, and then the first time it was opened, finally opened, it was a gala beyond galas. 1994, it was unbelievable. Yeah, we did it. And it was the ultimate expression of her pride of Cleveland, which we had worked on and were happy to be a key in promoting, along with so many other wonderful people from all over the business community, the civic community. And it was very exciting.
Do you still listen to music on terrestrial radio?
Yes, I do. And this is – I love WGCU's talk programming. I need spoken word. And I listen randomly or I'll listen faithfully to certain programs. But I also musically – I'll still listen to terrestrial radio. And we all know that, you know, formats are now formats. You're constrained to what's on the format. You're constrained to play what the consultant tells you you're allowed to play, and in that order. But even with that, there's still a great outlet for some really great music. My musical tastes are all over the board. I'm not just a rock and roll person. There's pop music that I've enjoyed. There's country music I enjoy. And so, yes, I still listen to terrestrial radio. And then I'm also a YouTube freak because I can find in YouTube one-off concerts, things that I've never seen or heard before.
Sure. Probably things you were at that you were like, oh, my God, yeah. It's on YouTube.
Exactly. And I'm, God bless those people for recording. And some of the pairings, you know, like Willie Nelson and Alison Krauss or Joe Walsh and Sheryl Crow.
Yeah.
Or, you know, just those pairings and those one-offs that you never see. Never was a popular. It was just a one-off performance or a brief show or a tribute show. It's really thrilling.
As you know, you already mentioned sort of, you know, music on the radio now is algorithm driven. They've got certain metrics and what song plays when. And even if there's a real DJ, they're probably pre-tracking it, mm-hmm. meaning there's probably very few examples anymore of somebody sitting there waiting for the song to end, turning on their mic, talking to you in real time. Mm-hmm. Do you think something's lost because of that? Because I do.
Yeah, it's some of the live performance qualities are lost.
Like what we were listening to with that guy back in when we played the thing from 76. Man, that had so much character to it.
Right. And that's missing because there's what I call an abuse of voice tracking, you know, and there's, you know, it's too synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like when there's an occasional flat note.
Yeah.
Or somebody misses a beat a little bit.
Yeah. Somebody says something goofy and starts laughing at themselves.
Yeah.
Or just anything like that.
And or you'll hear a little exclamation on the side, you know, or a little shout of joy. Those unfortunately get taken out or they don't happen at all.
Do you think there's room for that in the market or do you think that we're past that point?
Well, it's basically like processed food. You know, there's a big push for organic food.
Yeah.
And a push for good organic performance.
Yeah.
And then
let's start a radio station, yeah. Walt. I'll be the DJ. We'll do it live.
Yeah. And the problem, too, is in the concert environment, that's also, you know, that's also there. There's a lot of electronic support, if you will.
I listen to, and they don't do it live because they're very small budget, but there's a station, low power station out of Dunbar High School in East Fort Myers called 93.3 The Tiger. Ah. And because they're a low power station, you can only pick them up for about 2.5 miles in either direction.
Sure.
But also they're a nonprofit, so they can just play whatever they want. You know, they're not paying for what they play. And you get anything. I mean, anything.
Oh, that's
it
so
might be
nice.
Something from 1943 or it might be a song from 56 that even though you were there, you don't remember. It's anything.
Yes.
And I love it because it hits my house. So if I listen to radio on the – or music on the radio, it's the Tiger.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And the colleges in many cases still have those kinds of – high schools, colleges.
Yeah.
They still have that flexibility and that freedom.
Yeah.
But as more stations came on – you had more format, more derivations, and
mm-hmm.
titles of format,
mm-hmm.
more genres of music. And what happens, people tend to all stay in their lane.
Yeah.
And it's good in some ways, but not good for spontaneity, not good for creativity, in my opinion. Or it's a different kind of creativity.
I just love driving down the road and you're like, oh, now it's the traveling minstrel hour. And then they play like accordion and mandolin music for an hour. So anyway, it's just my little pitch for real radio.
You're right. And so one of the joys of that is the freedom to hear something or see a one-off.
Yeah, and to be surprised by something.
And I just stumbled on something that I forgot I liked as much as I did. Doug Kershaw, Louisiana Man. Cajun music. I listen sometimes for the mood I'm in.
Yeah.
And wow, what a great song that was. Or the band with Levon Helm. Oh my goodness. There, you know, the riverboat kind of music. So, you know, music is a wonderful gift that we can access. There's so many choices that we have, and you can choose whatever you want. And as much as you want or as little as you want. But we're blessed to have so much music, which is, you know, ultimately the expression of so many people's feelings, their love, their happiness, their sadness. It's all there. And it's a great human expression.
And as we tap into with this show, you know, you're broadcasting in 1976 out of a tower in Cleveland, and someone listening, something happens, and then they remember that moment for the rest of their life because of that music moment that you were a part of.
Well, we were just the messenger.
Well, of course. Yeah, you don't do it on purpose, but it happens.
And so we feel we were the we were part of that stool with the legs on it.
You know,
there was the radio station, there was the promoter, the record company, of course, most importantly, the artist.
All right. You ready for a speed round? We're going to ask you some random questions. Walt, do you have a nickname that has stuck over the course of your life you'd be willing to share?
The Furnace.
Okay. When was the last time you bought music that had physical form?
I acquired something recently, but I didn't buy it. It was a gift.
What was it?
It was an old album. It was an old Moody Blues album, Days of Future Past.
Oh, I love that album.
Yeah. And the reason it was important to me was it was a better quality. It's a thicker vinyl. It's like a re-release. And we used to get our records free, promotional copy with a hole drilled in it. And I gave close to 6,000 albums that I had acquired over time. Some never opened. I donated everything to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for their music archives a long time ago. But I just picked up a couple of CDs. I've got a large CD collection. And I know CDs are compressed and all that. But I just found some other old songs that I've fished out that I'm starting to listen to a little bit. So it's, again, my tastes run all over the place. But you stumped me on what did I just buy? Well, I didn't really buy it.
I know.
It was a gift.
That's evidence of how the world has changed. Do you do karaoke?
No.
If you were a championship wrestler, what music would you enter the arena with?
The Boys Are Back in Town.
What would your wrestler name be?
The Furnace.
Ah, you nailed that one. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
For me, it is. I like hot dogs.
If you had to guess, what song would you say you've listened to the most times in your life?
Wow. Good Vibrations.
What activities or pursuits make you lose track of time the most?
Reading books. Immersing myself in an adventure. I just finished a book called The Wager. It's about a ship that was trying to round the Cape Horn. And the ship,
like historical fiction.
And it was shipwrecked. And the men ended up on a deserted island. And it was – that makes me lose, you know, the local consciousness and just totally immerse myself in bigger and better adventures of life and death.
If you could choose to listen to a song and get to hear it for the first time ever again, what song would you like to hear with fresh ears and fresh brain?
Mm-hmm. I can't think of one.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You don't have to have an answer.
Yeah,
I can't, you can say, I don't know.
I can't think of one, right? What happens, my head's flooded.
Yeah. It's turned into a slurry of songs.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
This is an interesting question for you because of the job that you did and the world you lived in. If you could broadcast a song magically into the head of all of humanity in one moment of broadcast bliss, what song would it be?
God Only Knows.
Ah, that's a good answer.
By the Beach Boys.
By the Beach Boys. I'm hoping that our listeners know that. Best album of all time, in your opinion?
Good Vibrations. Excuse me. Take that back. Pet Sounds.
Pet Sounds.
Yeah, sorry. Pet Sounds.
Okay. What would your 14-year-old self think of who you are today and the life you've lived since you were 14?
I'll quote Jimmy Buffett. Some of it's magic, some of it's tragic, but I had a good life all the way.
All right. Well, it's time for you to recommend three people that you'll share this with that you think might do it. You don't have to guarantee they will, but you'll at least share it with them.
The first person that comes to mind is Mike Love of the Beach Boys. He's at a point where he has so much to talk about. He has such great stories. He's so well-versed. And I think if we can get him to do this, and I think he would
be honored to have him.
He would enjoy it because he wrote a tremendous book about his own journey in life. And I think, you know, he's at a point where he can look back and with great satisfaction and look back and say, look at all the things that we've been able to put together and all the people we've made happy.
Okay. Number two.
Second one is a local guy, Vincent Willannon. Vince is a very good friend of mine. Vince owns a company here called Private Sky Aviation.
The big yellow building.
Yeah, exactly. But he's a renaissance man. He's a developer. He's a builder. He's also a Grammy voter.
Oh, wow.
And he has a very talented daughter named Whitney Willannon, who's now a very, very accomplished video producer in Nashville. But he's extremely bright, well-informed, highly intelligent man, with a renaissance man, a master of many, many things.
Cool.
And an interesting personality who's been in this market forever and ever.
Cool.
And the last person would be a very good friend who's did me so many favors, that did in the radio business, helped me so many times, and that's Mike McVeigh. And he owns a company called McVeigh Media. Mike is a consultant for over 1,000 radio stations. He's arguably one of the most foremost accomplished radio consultants. And he has done so well in his business, in his industry, with taking stations and putting them on the map. He did amazing things for me in two or three of my markets when I would buy a station. And he would be the person that put the fabric of the music together, that organized it, that put it in play, and even helped staff it. So Mike McVeigh, he's tremendous. He's very polished. He's very, very kind and a very brilliant man. I'd recommend him.
We would love to get any and all of them.
I will be happy to contact each of these people.
We would appreciate it. Any final thoughts? You've done it.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you and WGCU for the privilege and the honor of talking a little bit about my colorful life.
No, we really appreciate it.
I don't often look back. This gave me a chance to look back. I kind of take the position of against the wind. You know, I'm still running against the wind. But at the end of the day, I try to respect the fact that, you know, that there are some things that we were done. And I'm most happy with the people we've entertained and have been able to entertain and the people I've been able to help with their individual careers.
Well, we appreciate your time today.
because people have left water at the well for me, and I want to leave water at the well for them.
For this week's parting tune, we're jumping back 1 year to episode number 268, guest Greg Longenhagen. He's an original founding company member of Florida Repertory Theater in downtown Fort Myers, and now its artistic director. His first song, Mr. Bojangles by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, took him back to a very specific moment in time when he was about 4 years old. He said he clearly remembers standing in the doorway of his sister's room, staring down at a record she had on the turntable, but hearing a song coming out of the radio. It moved him so much that from that moment on, throughout his life, his siblings have referred to it as Greg's song.
And I remember that song coming on. That's like, I don't know if it's the first time I remember hearing it, but I was so drawn, first of all, to the melody of it. I think I've always been, I don't know if it's the Irish in me or what, but I, you know, stories that are sort of have a melancholy tint, and maybe that's, you know, comes from my culture or where I, you know, how, you know, my bloodline, whatever. But I just remember being very drawn to the melody of it, but then also the story, because I felt so connected with this person who had this life. And what this Mr. Bojangles, what he did with his life and, you know, traveling around. And, you know, the images were so strong for me as a little kid to listen to it. I had such strong images of who this person was and his dog and the places he'd been. And, it was so, I can still see like the sunlight pooling through the room. I mean, I can see like the little bit of the dust in the air.
We make three song stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is host and online content producer. Our production assistant is Jared Gonzalez. Chris Duff is executive producer. And our theme song was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Keep listening.